Hi there, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. We are here again in another episode brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I'm your host, Katerina Stoikova. My guest today is poet and teacher Dave Harity. Hi, Dave. So happy to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is great. Great to be here.
Dave and I go way back. We met at the distant 2007, right?
Very pre-COVID, yeah.
When he was graduating from Spalding University with an MFA in poetry. He was graduating and I was starting. Basically, we were in school together for one residency, right? But
yeah,
we were in
so.
The same workshop. And
yeah.
Feels like a lifetime ago, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does feel like a lifetime ago. Crazy how long ago that was, actually. Yeah.
How different life was.
It was very different. Yeah. For both of us, for lots of different reasons, and for the world, I think.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. So, what are you writing these days?
I'm always a bit of a dabbler. I've always been good about keeping up with poems. I like poems a lot because I can write them kind of between things. I'm also working a little bit on essays and a little bit on fiction and a little bit on erasures, visual poems. So it's a bit of slow going work in a lot of different directions, but mostly it's been focused recently on finishing up a new manuscript of poems and as well as really trying to dial in some work around essays and prose or lyrical prose, or maybe they're either prose poetry or poetic or lyrical prose. I'm not sure which. We'll see what ends up happening. If there's any lines.
Sounds like rich creative life to me.
Yeah, it is. I'm really grateful for the ability to have time to write and be surrounded by a lot of really fun people to write with and to be able to share work with people is also a huge part of my own writing life. So even in times where I'm not actually out there publishing or hustling like that, I'm still writing and sharing work with friends. So that's been good, which I was remiss. I should have said Happy National Poetry Month. We're coming
yes.
at the end, yeah. But that's always a good time to share work, National Poetry Month.
Well, I want to ask you more about your manuscript that you said that you're finishing up. Or
yeah, I've got final passes on it going now. This stuff is iterative, right? I've been working on this in bona fide probably for about 2 years, taking breaks from it, trying to bring new poems into it, taking poems out, that kind of stuff. But it does feel like it's finishing up. It's a slim volume. But I think it'll be good to, have a tight group of poems. So it's a series of poems that sort of tracks my personal life in the past few years through, loss and grief and kind of renewal. Just kind of getting my life back on track. And there's a long kind of governing poem that is woven into the work to kind of create seasons or rests in between the pieces. So, yeah, it's been a fun book to write.
Do you have a working title?
I've been working with the title Halos. I like the book is very circular, Halos, I think, is a really appropriate word for it because of that circular sort of motif, but also kind of the atmospheric effects of halos make their way into the book quite a bit, as well as sort of the undoing of religious identities, which also has an obvious, tie. So it feels like a good title, but we'll see. It doesn't feel like a very descriptive title right now, but we'll see how it ends up working out.
It was interesting for me to hear halos because, yes, you're right, it means quite a few different things. And when I met you in 2007, you were coming out with a chapbook. And then, if I remember correctly, on your bio, it was Dave Harity is a Christian writer.
Oh, in the biography of the chapbook? That may, why, probably would have been in the biography, but I'd imagine someone probably commented on it in a blurb.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, faith has always been, and kind of faith motifs have always made their way into my work. And that hasn't much changed, you know, for all my own, like, personal evolution, back and forth, around those sorts of things. The thing that's grounded me maybe in my work maybe is like the literature of that I grew up reading in the Bible, which I don't think is much different for lots of people. You know, we all kind of have the totems that were given in childhood and those carry through. That was what I happened to get. So I rely on that those motifs a lot, but it doesn't necessarily have much grounding in a personalized faith. At the time that we met, I certainly was in a different place spiritually than I am now.
And that sounds very interesting to me, the people's evolution. And from what I'm hearing, your latest manuscript, Halos, is exploring that further.
Yeah, a little bit, for sure. I think it's exploring deterioration in a way that I haven't really explored before. And then the deterioration of faith or religion is part of that process in the poems. But in a similar way, like there's a renewal theme that kind of runs tangential that I think counters that and plays with that idea. So even the idea of coming into a new way of viewing the world or living in it or inhabiting it is part of the book as well. So it's deterioration and I think really the word I'm going for, what I really want the book to be about, is integration.
Uh-huh.
Trying to take pieces of my life, sometimes that make no sense, pain or joy, and bring them all together in one spot. So yeah, that's the hope. Yeah,
that's all we can hope for. Everyone.
Yeah.
I would love to hear a few poems if you want to share.
Yeah, sure. I can share some poems. That'd be great. This one's called The Branch. The homeowner deliberates on a ladder, examining protrusions and nubs, juts of a branch sagging over the house. See him brushing back heavy-leafed snaps. See him deliberating about where to cut and how, so as to cause the least amount of harm. It's uncomfortable to decide what should go or what might stay. In that moment, he conflates two parables from childhood. Christ telling a crowd that birds do not worry and still get fed, and another where Christ, without politeness, declares pruning virtuous, that the branch can't remain without the vine. Nothing to say or disbelieve, but to accept that the end must be the end, and don't concern yourself with what might be. The branch could bat about in the wind, in a storm, spit out its nests. The branch could split and fall and hurt someone, become firewood and keep his family warm. It could be felled and never thought about again. And thus, it can also be so many unnamed things, like a cross below a cloudless sky to which a crowd might pin a stranger and tell the story for 1,000 tired years. So many reasons to cut or not cut, not knowing which gospels aren't whole enough. There is a choice here, with a connection to a past he can't discern and a future he can't predict. And the present is ever rising out, bustling with its simple momentary decisions, worries where nothing can be done to change the outcome, the sun blinding him through the yellowed flippancy of sycamore leaves.
Wow. I love this. It's so rich.
Oh, thanks. Appreciate that.
And I love the questioning. Yeah, and the lack of answers, because every reader needs to provide the answers.
Yeah, I try to leave room for that in my work. In my own kind of personal journey, my young adulthood, asking lots of questions wasn't really a welcomed thing necessarily. And poetry became a place where I could ask questions and provide myself with answers, right?
The interesting thing about those unasked questions, they don't go away, you know,
right.
And they're going to surface at some point. The questions actually become more and more serious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They become more serious. They evolve. They present themselves in different ways. They ask themselves in different ways through different people, through different situations. And you constantly have to be present to trying to listen, which is something I'm learning to do. I think we're all probably learning to do it. But, yeah.
I would love to hear more poems now.
Yeah, sure. This poem is called Totality. Lying in bed, you read the lines on my palm and name what I'll become. Asleep or awake, my mind won't keep still. Eclipse of rumination, line of intuition, carved path. Go back, I tell myself, go back through the rut of dusks. Read the lines on my hands, a burnt future, furrowed litany, feathered, chained, crossed or petaled, each mark a wrong turn or a cut string, sleepwalk of promises I won't keep. And there it is, again, starlight blooming in the middle of the day above thin pines, night animals wandering a kingdom in me, winnowed more each time, breath on needles, asleep in damp sea mist.
What gorgeous poem.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah, quite frankly, I'm amazed that you were able to read it.
I am too. I just edited that one. So this is, you can't see it, but I'm reading simultaneously off of a phone with an old draft that has no markings and then a new draft. So this is the first time I tested that new draft. So we'll see how I'll revisit it later.
Well, you have rearrangement, you have word replacement, you have scratches.
Yeah, I'm a mess.
Yeah, you did great.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
What else do you have for us?
So I think one of the things that kind of happens in this book is it explores, you know, some childhood memories and then how those kind of feed into adult ways of living, right?
Yeah,
and then,
the circular nature of things.
Yeah. So there's a couple of poems in here that are just like kind of solidly low divorce poems. Mm-hmm. So, this is the blood on the tracks portion of the the reading. This poem's called Mortgage. There's always a debt, and this one is satisfied by the end. We became adults overnight with room after room, space enough to hold a future. Show me an imperfect thing, and I can name the kind of affection that built it. For me, nothing was exact, measuring my errors in beige tile and pale trim, garden rose and scattered seeds. I never kept track. I tried to caulk it clean, paint it over. Each morning you and I were new. Hello, goodbye, see you soon, until we forgot what we owed. Each evening sweeping dust in the hall and tidying up before bed. It's quaint but true that every house has a story where lives start and stop, but no home can name a beginning or end. We never finish paying. Instead, we split it, walk away, and leave behind a cellar of garden fruit and veg, jar after jar after jar, for a family we hope would make better use of it, make better use of what we couldn't preserve.
Stunning. Wow. I mean,
thanks.
It's devastating.
Yeah, this is a sad book. It was hard. It was sad to write. There's some hopeful one. You want to hear a hopeful one?
No, I want to hear another devastating divorce poem.
Okay, we can do that. Can do. There's always a devastating divorce poem.
Whoever wants to read happy poems, they, you know, I don't know, listen to pop music or something.
Yeah, that's true. I like both. I like writing both, but this book in particular has these moments of just complete deterioration, and the moments of integration in it that do exist are much more subtle.
Yeah.
So this one's called Mise en Scène. Playwrights have drafted, written, and built it to say one amends is never enough. Arranged to matter, the objects are subtle. Names branching on a family tree, a table set with conciliatory intent, and a candle flickering, casting light on two still actors waiting to begin. The meal will not be eaten, which means it's a story of strained half-truths untying, of a finger writing down the doom, that the room has only three walls, one door in or out, and one window with a painted sky, that the home is a gesture with more gestures inside. The scene starts with uneasy domesticity, and the end doesn't matter. The apology is easy to miss.
Wow.
Thanks. that's a good reaction. Silence is a good reaction.
No, I mean, these are brilliant. These truly are brilliant. And
thanks.
You're a philosopher. You're an observer and a philosopher. Read us one more, and then I have more questions.
All right.
You can read a happy one. It's fine.
I'll read a happy one. How's that? One of the things in this book that is interesting, or that's been fun, is I mentioned that long poem that's in there. I really like... Do you like writing long poems?
No.
No? You don't?
No, I don't think I can. Well, actually, here's what happens with long poems. I write them in pieces over long period of time, and then I realize, okay, well, I guess this is a long poem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it's very tricky to put one big long poem right smack in the middle of a book, or the beginning or the end. So...
Yeah.
In my latest book, I also have a large poem that I broke into pieces and scattered around and associated, you know, other poems such as commentary on it.
The UK book, right?
Yeah.
You read a couple of those at the reading in Louisville.
Right,
but they were great poems.
Thank you.
Yeah. I had that same thing too. So one of the things that was... interesting about this book was that I had this series of poems about walking at night and sleepwalking, which I'm a sleepwalker.
Really?
Yeah. We could talk about that in a minute, but the poems were coming out of those experiences. Sometimes even I've left the house. But not walking at night is really this one poem. And they were all these poems that I'd written over several years. And then I noticed that they were just kind of starting to pull themselves together, but they were all so different. And I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to just try to begin breaking them down syllabically and just kind of see what's in there, like, you know, pop the hood and see what patterns emerge, right? And so... This pattern began to emerge of 10 syllable kind of lines that I had just naturally done over the course of years. So I started trying to push them all into that form. But it was fascinating because this happens with long poems for me. So what you said, it really rings true in my experience.
Yeah.
Like I never set out to I'm going to write a long poem.
Yeah.
It just becomes these pieces that feel like they should be together and I can't keep them apart for much longer, and then they start doing their thing. It's like I think of making a book. You invite all your poems to a dinner party, right? And you see which ones are gonna get along with each other and hang out, and then some of them, of course, don't get along at all, and they can't hang out. So
you place them around a table. in a particular way.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Literally and figuratively. That's kind of how it goes in my mind.
So. Well, there it is, the circular, the circular metaphor again.
Yeah, totally. Yes. Everyone's looking at each other, right? We're all sharing something common and in a space together and seeing. Yeah. Well, here's one more poem for you. Let's do this one. This poem's called Avondale Road. And this poem was born out of a friend, a very dear friend of mine, passing away last year, named Reed Bush. I don't know if you ever met Reed, but he's a Larkspur author.
And, I have met Reed, yeah.
A wonderful, wonderful right. Friend. And he and Mary Boyd, his spouse, lived on Avondale Road. That's where the title comes from. Of course, the poem that this originally was written a long time ago. And some of those pieces in here remain, but of course over time it got kind of chopped up and lots of other things have made their way in. So, but just been thinking a lot about Reed this past year. And so this poem comes from knowing him, but then is also my own life and some facsimile there. So, Avondale Road. Day end, moon, a bangle ringed by blue charms. I reach down to swipe the stray grass from the sidewalk, think about wasted days before this one. An aging couple lives next door. One woman sits on the porch while her wife gardens, pulling apples from their small tree into a barrel, piling rotted ones. They share a bright, simple quiet. From memory, the movements are clear. Where one reaches, the other's eyes follow. Over time, they've grown nearly identical in stature and stare, save two distinct bodies, eyes. What exists, exists long before I noticed, sober, stayed. How easily we become indistinguishable from what we love. My hands unmake a knot tied decades ago. All past is present, is future. I want to reverse the direction. Decayed fruit coalesced again, rising with the stem knit back to the branch. My life becomes easy to swallow again as I pick at weeds, dig holes. Later, when I come to bed, you've been asleep for an hour. I wrote down this home long before I found myself in it. Still fire beside me, curve of your shoulder and hip pressed in. Your breath will be my breath and will be gone.
Mm, beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tell us about the Association of Theopoetics.
Oh, man, Theopoetics. Well,
what is Theopoetics?
Yeah. if I can answer that on during our time, that will be a miracle. The best thing, so Theopoetics is certainly an academic discipline in theology that concerns itself and focuses itself around the act of making and procreation. On a theological level, it
the act of procreation?
Of procreation, procreating, making something and okay. Putting it into the world. So yeah, not yeah, that's a really good field of theology. Creating something and then experiencing its existence is maybe a good way. I'm not a theologian, so I should say that. I'm an artist who made their way into this sort of academic discipline through some mutual friends who have overlapping interests. Theirs may be directed more at theology or practical theology, how theology is implemented in one's own life. Mm-hmm. For me, that kind of takes on the act of creating and mm-hmm. writing poetry. So my first book, Making Manifest, was a book of writing exercises that was designed to kind of help folks experience that procreative self mm-hmm. that they have, that mm-hmm. I think all people have. And so Theopoetics for me is really about practice of creating things. And I hesitate to try to define it. I think that's something that theopoetics is good at, just kind of lets itself be. Lots of people find it from lots of different disciplines. But for me, the act of creation, the act of putting down, and the act of that self being active, engaged, and dynamic in the way, in the world, is what that is. So, I think about Mark Rothko, right? So Mark Rothko, the painter, if you've ever been in front of a Rothko painting, one of the things that's fascinating about it is that it feels, even if the colors are like pulverizingly dark, it feels like it's luminous, right? Mm. It feels like there's light coming off of it almost. Of course, scientifically there is, but that effect, that affect that exists in it, I think is how I would describe theopoetics. Rothko, to do that in a painting, he would paint the canvas, and then he would take a rag with thinner on it, and he'd just wipe it down. So he would put the paint, let it sit, wipe it off, right? And you can imagine painting like that over time, right? These different qualities of the paint build on themselves.
Palimpsest.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, very similar to palimpsest. Yeah, yes, it's a form of that for sure. But I think when we're talking about theopoetics, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a dynamic thing that we're creating. And we're working it in different ways, angles. It's living, it's breathing, but it's the thing that we're creating. And so that's something that I think about in my work a lot. Practically speaking, that takes on revision, right? Where, I think that's where the real writing is happening. Every time, I've had a student say, I don't revise. I'm like, oh, then you have a problem,
you don't revise, that means you'll either stop writing at some point, mm-hmm. or you're about to learn how to revise.
Right.
I don't know of a third option. Do you?
No, I don't. I think that's a good way of saying it. Either you've already given up on it, you don't realize it, or you're about to learn something. Yeah. That's a really open-handed approach. Very Zen. I like that. Namaste, Katerina.
Oh, namaste.
Yeah. Do you revise a lot in your work?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your process like?
Well, for different poems it's different. I don't know if I can say my process is ABC for 100% of my mm-hmm. things. I just try to feel the work and understand what it needs, and some things need more revision than others. And I also understand that you could edit a poem beyond recognition, and you could squeeze all juice out of it, and it would feel like a poem, look like a poem, but it would be a zombie.
But it gone. Yeah. I've been there.
I do call those zombie poems.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because there is no life in them.
Yeah. Do you encounter those in the real world, like when you're reading journals and things like that, and you know when that's happened? Yeah.
I do. I recognize them as poems that are professional in the worst sense of the words.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything rough about them has been smooth to oblivion.
I want to ask you about your process, because, I remember your graduation lecture, so maybe things have changed since then, but I think it involves running.
Yeah, I do. I do run. Yeah. I'm a very kinetic person. I can't sit for long and write either. So often one of the things I'll do is I'll be working on a poem, and I'll take a minute, I'll go for a run. I'm not unique in this, I don't think, either. I know lots of writers or artists who are also runners. I don't know if you ever read Haruki Murakami's book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Running. I think it's something like that. Or What I Talk About When I Talk About Running. Is about kind of being a writer and also being a runner, and the overlap of those processes, or the overlap of those two different lifestyles. How endurance is required, of course, training. I think one of the things that sort of running has taught me is that really the contest that's happening is with you, right? The thing that you're trying to do with you is your own personal best, right? Mm-hmm. And it's easy to get caught up with in writing and in running, to get caught up with what other people are doing and how well they do it, and you know, but running definitely teaches you that if you can redirect yourself, that this is about you becoming your best self, and you challenging yourself in meaningful ways. So the running kind of comes into my process both as a break and as like a reminder that just stay the course, try your best, show up, you know, similar to writing.
Expend energy too.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Oh yeah. It's exhausting. Yeah. Yep. You show up to write, you put your ass in the chair and you can write. You don't do that, you can't write. You put your shoes on to run and you start to run, you can run. I started running, because I like drinking beer. So it became more of the beginning of writing or running became more of a, okay, if I'm going to consume like this, I need to have something that makes it so that I can do that. So I began running and I hated it at first. Oh my God, Katerina, I hated it. And I would set a timer and I'd say, okay, I'm going to run for the amount of this timer. And it started out for 10 minutes. And then about a month in, it became just, I kept going. Like at the end of that time, I'd be like, oh, I feel good, you know. And gradually just it became a habit. So,
do you get ideas while running?
Yes, sometimes I do.
And what do you do then? Stop and scribble it, or?
No, actually, part of the process of running that's been kind of important for me, running has been a place where I've tried to really very, very hard to not have any form of contest. In writing, it can be very easy to get deep and focused on your work and then how that work is going to get into the world and what matter, like, you know, it's easy to get wrapped around the axle with poetry business or writing business stuff, you know?
Yep. No, I've heard of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, running is a place where if I have an idea while I'm running, I don't stop. I try to remind myself of the idea, but sometimes by the time I get home, the idea is gone. And I've just allowed that to be the case. It's been a form of self-allowance and self-acceptance to just go, actually, you don't have to write everything down.
That is terrifying to me. Losing a good idea is terrifying to me. Oh, I don't know how you go to the point to let it go.
You have a mental breakdown. then you correct. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you can, if you looked in my bag right now, you'd find all little snippets of things.
But not while running.
But not while running. That's the only place I don't allow myself to take a note. It really is the only place. Nothing else is really sacrosanct in that way. But if I'm running, I intentionally don't carry my phone. I intentionally don't carry a pad of any kind. And so I just have to trust that if the idea is what it should be, it'll come back.
So let me tell you a story.
Yeah.
My husband and I are going to the gym. And, you know, I go on a treadmill. And then I get an idea. And then I turn around to him and it's like, I'm going to go home to get my notepad. And I did. And I came back, you know, and I wrote my ideas down. And then from that point on, I have never gone to the gym without a notepad and a pen.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, most of the time, futile. But I want to be prepared.
Right. When it strikes, yeah, show up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Show up.
That's a good idea. I carry a pad and I have a note on my phone that I keep track of stuff. I mean, it really is the only place in my life where I disallow it.
And
it's only because I think it's just good for me to be a bit humbled by the fact that your brain's giving you something, your mind's giving you something, your heart's giving you something, and you can have it, you can breathe it in and out, and maybe it'll be there, maybe it won't. Or it'll come, usually what happens though is it comes out in some other way, you know. I think that the idea sometimes, you get anxious to capture something, right, and you write it down, and then you never revisit it. It just kind of sits somewhere. For me, this is my thing. But then there are times where I don't write something down, and then I feel like the thought ends up returning to me, and it's familiar, but it's not the same. Like it's sat in the cockles of my heart or body or belly or whatever it is, and now it's back. And it's got something more interesting to say. Maybe.
Tell us about prophetic writing.
Oh, man. So the prophetic modality in writing is one I've always been fascinated about, whether that's like from biblical literature or in different ways, like with one of my favorite poets, William Blake, another Walt Whitman. The prophetic modality is really about the specific naming of paradigms of reality that go unnoticed if you don't name them exactly. And, you know, this often takes on a political paradigm, of course. So, you know, the Old Testament prophets were constantly wailing about about injustice, right? And I think you see that in Blake. You see that, of course, in Whitman. You see that all over the place. If you want to spend time with the prophetic, you don't have to go very far to see that. It's not an ancient practice, is my point, I guess. It's very contemporary and something that's alive and well in our tradition today. I think every year, every couple of years, we have these sort of galvanizing geopolitical events. We're seeing them now. We have galvanizing national events, and we see the prophetic coming out of that. People naming injustice, people naming what should not be, and offering correctives, alternatives. And I think that's what's going on.
I have scared myself with my own poems more than once.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
So
sure.
Speak about that kind of prophetic writing, too.
Oh, man. You mean like when you're writing something, and you're like, holy hell, where did that come from?
Or you look up a poem that you've written 20 years ago, and it's like, how did I know that?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that it came true. Yeah, that you wrote something that you couldn't have possibly known about at the time, but then ultimately it brings itself to bear. Yeah. I don't have many negative experiences with that. I've had more negative experiences where I've written something that surprised me that it, like I've been in a kind of a flow state or like a very focused state, and then something just starts coming out, and I don't know where it comes from. Like Our Father in the Year of the Wolf was a book that was that. Hmm. It just became these poems that were, quite honestly, like just very violent, very emotionally nightmarish, and you know, surely there's something in there driving it, but also who knows. And and so, you know, I think ultimately some of the destructions maybe that I wrote about in that book came to pass in my own life. One of the things that, so this is maybe an example of one of the things that I think of with this, and I think it's kind of what you're saying too. So the central poem in that book, called Our Father in the Year of the Wolf, was a poem that I wrote years before the publication of it, and the galvanizing event of that book coming together as a book was me finding a neighbor of mine who had completed suicide, and suddenly that poem made sense. I was shocked when it came out of me when I had written it years prior, but then that incident contextualized it, and I could see that was what the poem was really about. I think that that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And that's so it's never really happened to me personally where it's predicted something for me, but it's definitely happened. And I think that that's a really powerful thing about the poetic and the prophetic. It just that there are these sort of confluences of experience that we're having. You know, our body is taking in all this sensory information all the time, right? And so many things go unnoticed consciously, but they sit there, right? And interactions with people, I think, are a great example. I think that, you know, the body keeps the score, right? And if you're paying attention, you can sometimes pick up on what it's picking up on. Other times, you're totally oblivious. But I think maybe, you know, I probably wrote that poem. I know I wrote that poem. It's based on the house I was living in, about when I met that guy, right? And I knew him for several years before that day where I found him. And so there must have been something in there, maybe, you know, reading that. Who knows?
Feel free to not answer the next question. Do you have a spiritual practice?
I do. Yeah, yeah. I have no problem talking about those things.
People are different. So
Yeah. No, I appreciate the latitude. I have a couple of practices that have meant a lot to me over the course of years, in and out of my own spiritual journey and my own kind of personal emotional journeys. And there are three. For a long time, my family and I practiced Shabbat. So Sabbath, we had this sort of modified Friday to Saturday Sabbath practice that we took really seriously. Or maybe I took very seriously and forced them to take seriously. But I still take it seriously to a degree. So that was something that's really giving life, just kind of taking, unplugging, making the same meal, sharing that meal with friends. That's a spiritual practice that I really love having. I've gotten away from that because it can be inconvenient with teenagers to try to fit that in, but we have other variations. The second practice that's always been very important to me is I will various points in my life have consistently prayed the rosary and taken Eucharist. I'm not Catholic. I'm not Jewish either. Practice Sabbath, but I've just found a lot of something happens with my mind with praying the rosary that I really find enchanting and loving. And I love the Eucharist. There's something so beautiful about that practice, you know, communion, right? So that's one thing that is. But the practice that I've been mostly doing over the past few years has been tarot. So
vastly different things.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm a pilferer. I don't mind looking at the way other people do a thing.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, that's good because I don't think lots of people love it. I try to do it very respectfully. I get very deep into it and don't typically advertise these things either, like out in the world, you know. But I've done tarot now for, I guess, 5 or 6 or 7 years probably. Seriously, and I do it every month. At the beginning of the year, I do a large tarot spread, one card for each month, one card for the year, that's the theme. And then each month I do a new reading on those cards. And I write myself, and I can show you here, like I write myself a thing that I hang on my, so you can see.
Yeah, I see it.
Yeah, so these are the cards that I had. This was the annual card that kind of, these are the annual cards that kind of govern it. This was the month card. Here were the three that I drew. And then I have this little deck of Buddhist and Hindu totems that's been really interesting learning about, like, kind of the canonical narratives of Buddhism and kind of Hindu practice. So I have one of those there just to kind of help me with learning and whatever that god or deity or whatever it is saying. It gets kind of worked in there. But like, I wrote myself a note, right? So I take all the kind of things that I've learned from the cards and I kind of try to bring them together in just a couple of sentences about what the month is going to focus on and what I'm going to try to take and watch for during that month.
Well, there is a poetry book right there.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Maybe. We'll see. Tarot's been pretty popular with the poets these days. I don't know if you're into tarot or not, but it's fun.
Well, did you draw a card today?
No, I don't do a daily card. I know several poets who do that, but I don't do that. I do this kind of monthly thing, so it's kind of fun.
I think that is fascinating. You are fascinating.
Thanks.
I would like.
If you ever want a tarot reading, let me know.
Oh, absolutely, I do. I would like to hear one last poem.
Sure.
And then I have the closing question for you.
Oh, man. This poem is called Elegy. Tide foam salts the vein, silken scrum in a clutch of weeds. The sea keeps rising. Son of a gull, I spit brine from my throat, flit scraps of gabardine. The beach is a shame of small crabs. So many times I couldn't say goodbye. How will you recognize me in the next life with so stout a heart? Each wave sifts sand at my feet. Reaching in, you're the sediment bubbling in my fist.
What is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing you want them to remember from you or your class, what is it?
Make a little progress every day is the name of the game with creative writing. William Stafford, one of my favorite poets, one of the most important poets for me personally, used to write every day, and that's exactly where I got that practice. But he would say, with standards as low as I have, anybody can write. So people are often intimidated by the idea of trying to make progress on their writing every day, which I think is a shame because it signals that there's a disconnect between what the process is and what the process can be. And I'm of the mind that if you sit down to write, unless you somehow can't write physically because your hands are not able to, you'll be able to write something, and that is progress. So I try to teach my students that's really, really important. And I find that the ones that are the most successful, by that I mean the ones that develop practices of writing, and that those go on with them after my class, take that advice. So some of the students I've had that have gone into the world and gone on to literary careers or things like that, or artistic careers, that's something that they have found value in. So, yeah.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
Wonderful to have you on the show. Yeah.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.